This is the another in a continuing series of oral history interviews being conducted by the University Archives and Special Collections Unit, Galvin Library, Illinois Institute of Technology. I'm Ralph Pugh, University Archivist, and interviewing along with me is Adam Strome, Director of University Archives and Special Collections. This is the 1st of May, 2018. And we're speaking today with Dr. M. Ellen Mitchell, faculty member in the Department of Psychology, first dean of the College of Human Sciences at IIT, and before that, dean of the College of Psychology. So thanks for coming and spending some time with us this morning at Galvin Library.
My pleasure.
Great. The first question, we don't simply focus in on IIT history. We want to have a sense of your broader career. You know, you have an existence outside of here. So we'd like to hear about your early years, your formative experiences, how you came to decide on your discipline, and what you feel you brought to it in terms of your formative experiences and your personality.
Gosh, that's a big question. You know, I recently had some students ask me how I came to decide to be a psychologist. And my response to them was that, it just seemed like a continuation of who I was. And so, you know, getting a doctorate in clinical psychology was sort of a natural path for me. I look back and sometimes I wonder how choices I made along the way may have fundamentally changed where I went. For example, when I was at Yale in my clinical internship, I was offered a position at the Depression Research Unit, which would have totally changed my path, I'm sure. But the wisdom that I had at that time was sound, and I knew that if I did that, I might not finish my dissertation in the way that I needed to, just like another person who was 9 years ABD there. And so I chose a different path, in part driven by my commitment to want to actually provide services to people who were underserviced. And at that time, my vision of my career path was that I would be in community mental health, which I did do for a period of time. And I headed outpatient services in a community mental health center after an entry-level position. And one of the things that was happening in the world was that Reagan had taken office and community mental health was being systematically defunded. And even while I was on my internship, people were closing state mental hospitals. And the state system had a bad reputation, but it served some really important functions. And it created an environment for people who didn't otherwise have one in the culture. And in those, I actually had worked in a state hospital, lived on the grounds in Connecticut, in Newtown, where those school shootings later happened, and came to understand that there were some people who worked on the grounds of the hospital who had a meaningful existence there who wouldn't otherwise be able to work outside. But the political view at the time was that their labor was being exploited, and that they wouldn't be able to garden, for example, or they wouldn't be able to sweep floors without getting a wage that matched, you know, entry-level wage. So there was a lot of, you know, there was a lot of debate about sort of mental health services for people who were severely mentally ill. And all those systems closed, and then community mental health was being compressed. And I had a day where I'd had a caseload of at least 3 homicidal clients and at least 7 suicidal clients, and I had gotten a subpoena for a guy I had never seen who somebody scheduled for an intake with me, but he never showed up. I never even knew his name, but he had shot somebody. So they wanted to subpoena me because they felt the Community Mental Health Center was responsible because we didn't somehow chase him down for not showing up. And I found that I was also retraining my staff. I had a staff of therapists who ranged from sort of master's level social works through PhD psychologists who were long-term psychologists trained under old models. And I was retraining people and thinking that probably the most important thing I could do was actually be in a training setting where I could train people to work with those with the most need and the best sort of evidence-based approach. And you know, and for me, there was also sort of a fundamental issue about lifestyle and community mental health. I was working 60 or 70 hours a week sometimes. My compensation was low, and I was, you know, on a path to being burned out like other colleagues because of all
of that.
Where was
this operation located?
Well, at that time, I was in Indiana.
Okay.
And but I worked in mental health center, a number of different mental health centers. I also worked in a VA hospital in Asheville, North Carolina.
Okay.
And you know, earlier when I was working my bachelor's degree, I worked in a school for autistic kids before they even knew what autism was.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I was kind of nomadic at that time in my life. I won the prize in my high school reunion for living in the most states ever since graduation,
right.
Which are many.
Yeah. Your PhD is from the University of Tennessee. Are you from the Upper South?
Oh, no, I'm from New Jersey.
You are? Okay, all right. But you did migrate through there.
I lived in New York, New Jersey, Connecticut, Tennessee, North Carolina, Ohio, Detroit, Michigan, Illinois, Indiana. I mean, I was kind of restless. And that's probably still true about me, which was part of the reason IIT was good for me, because I could do a lot of different things here. So in any event, I had decided that the best thing I could do was to move over into an academic setting and really focus on training people. I had, at the Community Mental Health Center, set up an APA-approved accredited internship program, which was training. And then IIT had posted a position for the clinical program for somebody to take over their practicum placement system and develop that.
Okay.
So I was hired on a one-year contract.
And it was 1986, 87?
So that was, let's see, that was 87.
Okay.
And
Yeah, that was
87.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Okay.
And I recall at the time Steve Haynes was the director of clinical training, and I said, well, I'm going to apply for the regular full-time position. And he said, well, you'll never get it. You're not a researcher. And I said, well, in time, I will convince you otherwise.
Okay.
And I did.
Okay.
So, you know, one of the other things that occurred was that I started at IIT in August, and in August I found out I was pregnant with my first child. So here I was sort of in this, like, situation of not even wanting people to know I was pregnant, because the presumption at that time was that you weren't serious about your career.
Mm-hmm.
And my first daughter, bless her heart, came 3 days after the grades were due.
It's very nice of her.
So I had the summer off. There was no such thing as maternity leave at that time.
Mm-hmm.
There was no, and I interviewed for the full-time job very pregnant. And was hired on a tenure track position. So.
Yeah, when we spoke with Ruth, we invited her to speak about her experience and perspectives on being a woman in her particular line of work and whatnot. Yeah, this might be a point to flesh that out a bit before we go back to the chronology. Yeah, just your mentioning that you had to mask your pregnancy and whatnot. And I think in one of the publications later on, you mentioned your pride in how your department and your institute was the best female represented on campus and whatnot. How was it just, oh, well, that's something I have to deal with, and you just sort of go by it? Or how did you try to address that more systematically in terms of your career and promoting the career of other women in psychology?
So 3 years later, I was pregnant with twins who came in July, and again, we had no maternity leave, and we didn't reset the tenure clock either, and I wasn't tenured. So because it was twins who came in sort of mid-July, I took off the fall semester, but I was expected to still, you know, produce in accordance with my tenure clock, which had not been reset from my first daughter nor from my twins. So that's a pretty big burden.
Yeah.
Plus, as you might recall, I was doing practicum placement, which as a service load I didn't get release time from my teaching to do that.
Mm-hmm.
And so I had you know, a yeoman's share of responsibility, as did many other women. And I think that, you know, there's pretty good evidence that women in academia in particular get overburdened with service responsibilities. One of the good things about psychology was that psychology increasingly was dominated by women. And so we had more women than any other part of the university. And, you know, I started organizing lunches. Marianne Smith was involved in that. Marianne's office, general counsel's office, helped fund the lunch. Mm-hmm. And we started like a women's gathering of faculty, both to just let each other know what we were doing so collaborations could occur, mm-hmm. but also to address, you know, what were some of the concerns and how people might address them in the institution. And I think Lou actually was very good about supporting women.
Right.
You know, he had a good reputation in the law school for hiring women, and the law school had more women than other typical law schools at that time. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, I think he was really a supporter of women here.
Right.
But IIT, institutionally, has a terrible reputation that way. Mm-hmm. You know, the women leave. Mm-hmm. You know, they don't find it a supportive environment. There's some departments that have only mm-hmm. hired the first woman in the last, you know, 10 or 15 years forever. Mm-hmm. You know, which is hard to imagine. There, you know, I think I was thinking about that this morning because in a recent faculty meeting, I was thinking about the fact that Pat Laughlin was replaced by a male CFO, and mm-hmm. and Jeannie Hardick in marketing was replaced by a male, and probably the new provost is going to be male, and most of the department chairs are male. And it's, you know, I think we were making progress, and I'm not sure we've maintained it. I'd have to actually look at the counts, which I haven't, but the landscape looks...
Yeah, and that really does come down from very much on top. I know from my experience, just to link up on that, promote what you're saying, my time at the Historical Society of Chicago, I was there for 23 years.
Yeah.
You could see that gender ratio vary director by director, and it really came down to how supportive they would be to getting more of a gender balance or not.
Right.
Did you feel that Lou made that difference right away, or...
Yeah, you know, I felt very supported by Lou.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and in part, my view is performance is everything, so if you're doing well, you get supported. But also, I mean, I think he really had a commitment to bring women on board.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he brought in Donna Robertson, he brought in, there's any, you know, I can't name them all, but Rose Milkowski was in the mix, Bev Perret in HR, and, you know, Mary Henry had a prominent role, and the women were, I think, recognized more. You know, there's some evidence to suggest that women in professional roles also, there's not much forgiveness for mistakes, whereas men, we can think about our current political environment.
Correct, yes.
Frequently are forgiven all kinds of things, and I think that's been true here, that there are women who've, you know, just made learning errors and then suffered disproportionately for that.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And in general, I feel like for people that kind of arrived at the school around the time you did, I think we've both always found it interesting to kind of ask about the landscape of IIT in general in kind of the mid to late 80s. You know, what was kind of the feeling around campus? How did it kind of differ from, you know, the school that you work at today?
Tom Martin had just left when you got here, right?
Tom Martin had just left. Mm-hmm. They just hired Mayer.
Mm-hmm.
Mayer was an interesting character who I think hurt the institution by jumping ship so quickly. He was valued by the people at Life Sciences for having arranged to get the sidewalk from the east side of State Street to the west so that we didn't have to walk through the mud getting from. But, you know, in terms of accomplishments, that was the one that was meaningful to us, but he left before very much else was done. And then, you know, we had Henry for an interim and things... I think that there was, among the faculty that I met, there was sort of an oscillation about the letters from that Tom Martin had issued that were, you know, notoriously known as A letters and B letters. A letters, you're going to be retained. B letters, you should expect you're going to be released, including, you know, regardless of tenure status, is how it was discussed. And I think there was a lot of anxiety about all of that, and people understood that we were financially in a difficult situation. People understood that there were conversations about closing the Mies campus, if not being sold to the University of Chicago, perhaps going out to Wheaton. You know, most of the time, faculty just kind of try to keep their heads down, do their work, but it's hard sometimes when that's buzzing. You know, the reorganization, I know for a lot of faculty was chilling because of what happened with mergers of departments like biology, chemistry, and physics, and mechanical and materials engineering, and, you know, I can't name them all. But, you know, at that time, Lewis College, which was letters, right, was also going through some transitions that sort of signaled the later reorganization. So I think Lewis used to have 9 departments, and then they started splitting them off. Like computer science used to be in Lewis, and humanities and social sciences were in Lewis, and math was in Lewis, and, you know, so it went from like 9 to 7 to then, you know, the bigger reorganization in which psychology emerged in a much better place. You know, and we did that. We were graduating more PhDs than any other part of the university, so we were responsible for the Carnegie ranking status. I think we were Category 1 at that time. Now we're Category 2. We had stable and growing enrollments at the graduate level. We had national ranking at the graduate level. And because we did graduate training predominantly, we fit with the new conceptualization of the university that came out of you know, Lou had the, I'm going to get the phrase in a second,
the
National Commission
for IIT.
Yeah. You know, and the National Commission reconceptualized the university. So we became, I mentioned this to Adam, you know, we became organized around the idea of professions. And so instead of sort of a conventional university where you have, you know, a college of engineering and a college of this and that, we were organized by professions. So it was engineering and architecture and design and law and psychology and the, you know, and the sciences. And there was sort of a view that the strength of the institution was with the graduate training, and it really wasn't as an undergraduate institution, and that we needed to leverage that strength. And so psychology became its own institute, and there was sort of this political tension. So Pat Whitney was already Institute of Design, and, you know, I remember there being a conversation about what would I be titled. And it was like I wasn't going to be dean because we weren't as big as engineering and we weren't as big as sciences, but I was in effect a dean, but I was going to be called a director.
All right.
Which, you know, what do I care?
The great use of the term director starts to really appear on campus in the mid-90s.
Yeah, so Patrick was a director and I was a director and the others were deans.
Yeah. Quick question. That's a very important turning point, obviously, the National Commission. Just tell us for a minute or two what the Department of Psychology was like in 1987 when you entered it. What sort of legacies were still holding on? And just give a little bit of a backdrop to the changes then that came in the 90s.
So it was
the mix between the clinical and the industrial. You know,
You know, it was a sleepy department that was starting to make inroads in terms of defining themselves. So in 1983, the clinical program applied for APA accreditation, was accredited. So the clinical program was stabilizing and strengthening. IO had been a presence for a very long time.
Okay.
But, IO psychology has kind of gone through its own professional identity changes. And ours in the early days was mostly in testing. We continue to have strength in test validation and psychometric theory. And then there were people from counseling who were sort of phasing out at that time, but rehab was growing. And there was, you know, rehab was interesting because, you know, the ADA laws had just been passed and people were starting to recognize that we actually need to have services and accommodations and things for people with disabilities. And, you know, one of the things that we always talked about is how everybody will have a period of disability in their lifetime. They just don't know what, they don't know when, and they don't know how long. And so the rehab program was important. And then, you know, we had this leftover from experimental psychology, which was...
Is that all back to Boder's time? Or?
It probably did, go all the way back there. But you know, even experimental psychology nationally was sort of, psychology was changing. So some people went to human factors, and some people went to cognitive neuroscience, and some people, you know, experimental psychology differentiated. But the people from the experimental program mostly provided undergraduate training.
Okay.
And, you know, we decided that if we were going to have an undergraduate program, we should close experimental psychology, which the faculty voted to do, and then build a different kind of undergraduate program and try to build our undergraduate enrollment.
Okay, all right.
Which we worked on forever with varying degrees of success.
All right. Right. Oh, good. Thank you. I just wanted that backdrop to the great real turning point for the university and for the college and for yourself in 1995.
Yeah.
Around there. So.
Yeah.
Yeah. Was that an exciting appointment to get? I assume so. How much of a blank slate did you have, or how many political considerations did you have to tackle once you took over as director?
You know, like I said, I'm kind of restless, so that was good for me because I like building things, I like new challenges. You know, I had decided that psychology needed a board, that all of the various entities had a board. My goal was to put together a board. I thought I could do that in 6 months. It took me 18.
All right.
Yeah. But we had a board. I brought with you a book we have relevant to the Board of Overseers. This now is titled College of Psychology, but it goes back. If this doesn't have everything. If I find the rest of it, I'll give you the rest of it. But
okay.
And
you're making an archival donation.
Yeah, a couple. and we you know, we have the Center for Research and Service, which was a consulting center, which for us was a revenue stream.
Mm-hmm.
And we were, you know, we were under a new revenue model, the first iteration that I know of revenue-centered management has RCM is one of the acronyms. There are others too, responsibility-centered management. And what we had decided was we would do our own fundraising and build our own revenue center, and that we were small enough in the institution that it wasn't really realistic to think we would be anybody's priority other than our own. And so with a lot of, you know, probably naivete and grit, we set out. And so, you know, we had a few people, inaugural people. This also has a lot about the history of psychology here, which I will give to you. You know, we wrote a mission statement. We listed our historical contributions. We started publishing our own materials. I had gone to an admissions open house and realized that the admissions department had not even one piece of paper about psychology, and that one of the prospective students told us later that they had gone to a table and said, "Can you tell me about the psychology program?" And the admissions person said, "We don't have one." And so we decided we would, so we even have a recruitment and marketing history here, progression. We started our own brochures, we started our own newsletters, we...
Classic lack of communication across campus, right?
It wasn't centralized, but in some ways that had a benefit, because we could really represent ourselves, and who can do that better, right?
True.
And so... You know, I had a board that Dave Vitale, who was still on the IIT board, was one of the inaugural members. Brian Dunn was our first chair, who now is my spouse.
All right.
Which is a wonderful gift IIT provided to me a long time down the road. Bill Bartholomew was a trustee. We had Jim Kiley. We had a number of board members, big board members, and then we had alumni. You know, mm-hmm. and so we had the Pritzker Galvin Challenge. Mm-hmm. So mm-hmm. we would be matched dollar for dollar, and that was a great incentive.
It's a great time where you were in your career, still very young, but with certainly a dozen years or more behind you in terms of different disciplines, and it sounds like you're very nuts and bolts. You wanted to make a sustainable and vital operation, and you put together the different supports for it and the different new initiatives and whatnot, so it must have been thrilling.
It was, and there were a lot of opportunities for things across the campus. So we had faculty who were working with people in engineering and assistive devices, and we had, you know, I still tease Hamid that, you know, issues around getting people to be energy efficient and ecologically aware really are human issues, and he needs a psychologist always on his team. And to Vince Torito, who wanted to invent an artificial pancreas, I said, Vince, you need a psychologist because people are still going to eat poorly and they're not going to exercise and they're just going to ruin their new pancreas. And you know, sort of the theme about human issues in technology was a theme that became ours at every opportunity that we could. Tammy Scher was one of the faculty members in the clinical program, received the largest grant ever awarded an individual investigator in the history of IIT, and it was in psychology, which, you know, people never thought of us as a research unit.
Right.
You know, and her work was looking at couples' communication to decrease cardiac risk. You know, so we had a health component and an interdisciplinary. I started doing work with Laurie Andrews Science, Law, and Technology, and you know, other people also were doing things that were different in psychology in some ways. So, and that was a lot of fun. And we stumbled on the Boder papers. Mm-hmm, you know, mm-hmm, that was such mm-hmm. a great project. And it certainly wasn't core to psychology's mission, mm-hmm. but it was one of those things like, how would you not do that?
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Absolutely.
How would you not?
Yeah. So it sounds like your work and the work of psychology in general at that time kind of predates what has become a more kind of the more recent emphasis on interdisciplinary work and kind of breaking down some of the boundaries between departments and colleges on campus.
So nationally, people were doing that already. You know, IIT has a tendency toward insularity. You know, we're all kind of bookish. We all kind of do our thing, and it's a small institution, and it's thinly resourced, and the infrastructure was weak, and so I think that there were things people might have done otherwise, but, you know, they were focused on their own survival, understandably.
Yeah. But yeah, you're in a great discipline like history where it can overlap with, if people are willing to see its benefits to their particular programs, then yeah, so it's...
There's almost nothing that psychology doesn't stick their nose in.
Right, yeah.
You know, the question was whether or not we also had core expertise in a particular element. You mm-hmm. know, we had discussions about really launching a human factors program. Mm-hmm. And what was clear was that, you know, you don't launch a program with a single faculty member and that there weren't resources mm-hmm. to... you know, put together a group, mm-hmm. and you know, we wanted to maintain the strengths that we had, so it wasn't like we were going to take clinical faculty and divert them or rehab or IO. That was our bread and butter. But we did make efforts to build the undergraduate program and make explicit faculty lines for the undergraduate program mm-hmm. to build that. And the center was interesting because, so I mentioned I wrote a business plan with some help of others. We'd had a small quote center that was running on contracts that individual faculty had obtained. So Chow Lam had one with the Department of Human Services from the state of Illinois to do some rehab assessment.
Sure, sure. Just for the record, Center for Research and Service.
Yeah.
That's what you're speaking about. Yeah. Okay.
And Namraju had some contracts to do test validation. Mm-hmm. And Steve Haynes, who left, had some assessment contracts. And there was a sort of a support for the idea that we would launch a consulting center, and that would allow us to train our graduate students better and also bring in revenue that we needed to operate and to fund students, because funding graduate students has always been a challenge. And so I wrote a business plan and took it to the Board of Trustees, and I remember one of the trustees saying, I thought we made an agreement that we weren't going to fund any initiatives that people have to bootstrap, because I was asking for startup money. Mm-hmm. To hire the director, and I had a plan for when we would break even and when we would pay it back and all of that. And bless his heart, Bob Pritzker said, yeah, but this is a really good idea and we should get behind it. Mm-hmm. And we beat the projection. We were breaking even in the first year, and I had hired Bruce Fisher, I believe that was 1991. And then the center, you know, we had contracts with United Airlines. We had contracts with, I believe, Aon Insurance. There's some of those in here. We started the CPS contract in the center to do the gifted and talented screening. Mm-hmm. We've funded countless graduate students, and we hire undergraduate students on those projects. And it really, Bruce Fisher was amazing. Mm-hmm. He dedicated so much. Were you going to say something?
Well, I was going to ask, you know, so it sounds like this was planned as this was planned as a way to produce revenue for the department,
right.
But it sounds
there's a big difference.
Yes, yes.
And I'll get to that in a minute.
but it also sounds like some of the early activities, you know, have continued to kind of echo to this day.
Yeah.
And so how much do you think the center became what you thought it would become, and how much do you think it has kind of been, I don't know, maybe more than you thought or more than you had initially hoped for?
You know, we were thinking big, and it became what we hoped it would be. I think it's actually smaller now.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that psychology being a department has hurt us in that regard. You know, we had an agreement in the revenue-centered management model that if the center made money over their budget, because you can't say profit, we're non-for-profit, right? You can't have unrelated business income, that we would be able to retain some of that to build the fund to endow a chair in psychology. And psychology didn't have any endowed chairs, and again, it was clear that we weren't going to be anybody's priority for that. And the center, in fact, the work of the center funded the endowed chair that we now have, that Ron Landis holds as the first chair in psychology.
Hmm.
So that was a big accomplishment, and that was one of the things that we put out at the front end of the center. We made a videotape about Namraju. We wanted to endow a chair in his honor. He was still alive, but he was internationally known for his work in test validation. And Ron holds the Namraju chair. Nam died suddenly while on the faculty, which was a terrible trauma for people. He actually was getting a stress test at a hospital and had a heart attack during the stress test and died like in 90 seconds. It was terrible. But, you know, the center allowed us to endow that chair, and the center allowed us to fund students, and the center of income allowed us to do things we wouldn't otherwise have done because we were way under budgeted. And there were views of others in the institution that we were getting more than our share because they didn't understand that we were just building our own. But they thought we were getting it. But we certainly were not getting it from the central budget.
Okay. Well, go on to those changes you're you're alluding to.
Yeah, we've done some foreshadowing.
Right. Yeah.
I'm trying to think of which ones, because I
the institute to department.
Mm-hmm. So Lou left. Mm-hmm. John came in with, I think, a more traditional view of a university.
Okay.
And I remember having a conversation with him about, explain to me why this makes any sense to be your own college.
Mm.
Alan also wasn't sure why we would be our own college. And there was some sense that the university needed to look more conventional to compete with other, this is my interpretation, with other institutions. And we started being modeled, you know, after Carnegie Mellon and RPI, mm-hmm, the places mm-hmm. where John and Alan had been.
Mm-hmm.
And as an institute, we had certain benefits in the university by virtue of how the university was organized. So, for example, I attended board meetings from psychology.
Mm-hmm.
We had our own fundraiser. We always had a representative in the faculty governance system from
mm-hmm.
psychology,
mm-hmm.
in the tenure review system from psychology. You know, we had our own admissions recruitment person. I had gone from one staff in psychology to five.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and this is because we basically self-funded our positions. You know
mm-hmm.
what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
And one of the things that happens when you're not a college, when you're a department, is that then you have a representative from your otherwise college. So
mm-hmm.
now on tenure committees, it could be somebody from humanities, social sciences, or psychology.
Mm-hmm.
There's a fundraiser for the college. There's a market. There's not even a marketing person anymore for the college that went away.
Right. Yeah.
You know, so we really lost in that transition.
Right. Yeah, Olivia's now elsewhere. And
she's still with the college,
yeah, okay.
but,
mm-hmm.
you know, she's part-time.
Mm, okay.
And the full-time position is gone. I had managed to get 1.5 people doing fundraising, you know, and we had success, and we, you know, engaged our alumni, but that Ken Biggers was the last person in the full-time position, and, you know, he's not with the college anymore, and there's not another person. We had a grants person. The research office here is thinly staffed to manage all the grants and contracts in the institution.
Mm, yeah.
And so we, with grant money, hired a grants person to help with the management of the funds and the reporting and all of that. There's really a lot of work. And that position is gone. We don't have necessarily anybody sitting on the tenure committees, is... When you're in a discipline that's not fully understood by your cross-disciplinary colleagues, that could be, tough.
Certainly. Yeah.
Do you think? So it sounds like in the days as an institute, you were fairly self-sufficient.
Absolutely.
And do you, in your opinion, if psychology continued to be an institute to this point, do you think that you would have continued to be self-sufficient?
Yeah, and I think we'd have way more undergraduates enrolled. You know, the other thing is that the effort for recruitment of undergraduates really collapsed. And if you look at the numbers right now, they're less than double digits. They're single digits,
mm-hmm.
you know. And we worked hard to get into the double digits
mm-hmm.
and then
mm-hmm.
to build it.
Mm-hmm.
but that... You know the university is having trouble with admissions overall.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
You know, and when Alan went to the board about Lewis College of Human Sciences, what he actually said to the board was that he was going to put resources in there, and he envisioned that Lewis would provide an additional 600 undergraduates, that we had capacity,
mm-hmm.
but there really weren't resources forthcoming, and so you know, and then there was. You know, by governance, I was an interim dean because it's a new entity, and then there was a search, and there was a sentiment that bringing new blood, since I'd been a dean for 18 years,
mm-hmm.
and Alan was building his own team,
mm-hmm.
that
mm-hmm.
it was time to do something different. And, you know, I think people from the outside have a hard time understanding IIT.
Mm-hmm.
We have a lot of layers.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
mm-hmm.
there's never one answer to a question.
That's true. That's true. That's true. The this is why these interviews are so great, because you're not going to find it in the official literature of the university, that statement you made about under Lou Collins, the emphasis on professions,
right,
and under the two successors, the emphasis on more conventional academic.
Yeah.
And again, right from the very top on down, has huge ramifications for everybody in every corner of the university. So.
Well, and I frankly think we've had an infrastructure crisis for like 30 years from Tom Martin, with deferred maintenance and, systems. Part of the reason that people developed local systems is that the central systems didn't work, so you've locally figured out how to hire students, how to pay students, how to fund, do your own fundraising, how to, and I think that In that context, then, there also wasn't a clear understanding about the extent to which those local operations kept things running smoothly.
Yes, yes. Mm-hmm.
So then when you shift, all of a sudden, students are saying, I can't get paid, or, faculty are saying, I've gone through six things trying to get this thing form through, or this, process.
Right, yeah, but a lot of these units, both here and at other places, are real engines that can be very self-sufficient and do power the larger enterprise.
Yeah.
But it does boil down to top leadership either feeling comfortable with those autonomous units, or if they're not comfortable with it, then the deck is reshuffled.
Yeah, and we did a lot of things because we could, We had no furniture. We had the worst furniture on the planet. Margaret Hike years ago had gotten chairs donated from a morgue or a funeral home. Yeah,
wow.
And they were purple velvet black chairs. But we found a used furniture store, and we found a company that was moving, and we got chairs donated, and we got a conference room table from a law firm that was moving, and we got, we were very do-it-yourself. People would look at us with envy, like, where'd you get that great table? somebody gave you money in your budget. I'm like, no.
You don't want to know. It's right. It came from resale or whatever.
That was what we did. If we wanted to be better, we had to, find a way. So this was a book that we had put together actually to sort of, when we brought in new trustees or board members, we gave it to them about psychology. And I had given, I worked under, I think, five different provosts. And most of them didn't understand why psychology should be an institute, so I had to go through that conversation multiple times with people like Stuart Cooper, and I worked for Haasen, I worked for Stuart, I worked for Alan Meyerson, I worked for Alan, the other Alan, now President Cram, somebody else in there. How soon we forget, right?
It's always the most recent.
This has some markups because it's a personal copy of mine. And we were developing specialty tracks and certificate programs and ways to build our academic presence.
Yeah, I'll just say for the record, this is a handoff of some pretty unique material to us here. So thank you.
And this one, the portfolio has like data, so you can see how the admissions increased and the enrollment increased. You can see the trajectory of our fundraising. You can see our priorities in there, and it's kind of a really nice historical document.
Yeah, this is great. For our purposes, maybe it would be great if everyone felt like they had to continually justify their existence and had one of these on hand.
Well, at the end of the day, I failed, right? Yes, because we became a department, and that was that's tough. Even our present location, we now are in Tech Central, which doesn't have its own entrance, and we don't have any academic programs next to us, and so our place in the university has become increasingly hidden. Which is, makes me sad.
Yeah.
And contributed to my sense that it was time to retire. It's a different era. It's not.
Yeah, we all have had to deal with those changes and institutional changes that may or may not be in sync with where we're at.
Yeah. Well, and exciting things happened in the library. I remember the cork floor.
Yeah.
And that was another example of kind of grit, so hair. really found a way to do it.
Yeah, push things through.
Yeah.
But you're a very practical person. So how have you handled the changes in the last, what's it been now, 4 years? And new self-set goals for yourself? And how's it been in terms of semi-retirement?
Well, you know, originally I thought I would just, you know, come back into the faculty and build my research program again, which had diminished.
Mm-hmm.
And I have a lot of interests, you know. And I had also spoken to Alan about a number of things I could do in the university, you
mm-hmm.
know, an initiative to really build linkages to bringing women on board and retaining women, linkages for the I chaired a committee about the Innovation Center, and we proposed a structure for the Innovation Center to get mm-hmm. started. And what I had said to Alan was, you know, I could do this and bring it to a point where hiring a director, there would be a something to hire them to,
mm-hmm.
as
yeah.
opposed to just an idea. And I,
yeah.
you know, said, you know, we could, I had like 5 different things. And what was clear was, you know, those were all good ideas, but that's not where he was headed.
Mm-hmm.
And so there wasn't going to be a role for me in the university. And I start, mm-hmm. and launching a robust research program that's funded is a time intensive, you know, it's a multi-year thing. It's like maybe by year 5 you're really rolling at the mm-hmm. level you need to be. And
mm-hmm.
I'm of an age where it's like, why would I put all that effort into building something that then I would retire from in pretty couple more years? So I'm,
mm-hmm.
you know, what I said to the faculty yeah. in psychology is like, I'm not the oldest person in psychology. I'm not even the second oldest or the third oldest person.
Uh-huh.
You know, I have a lot of energy, I have a lot of interest, and it's time for me to do something different.
Mm-hmm.
So,
and one of our standard questions is think archivally, think historically. Even with all this wonderful documentation you've turned over to us, what sort of things are in the interstices? What sort of things are not going to be clear from the paper record to the published record? You know, you've already told us a number of those things as well, but yeah, it's that real first person. Other sorts of, you know, what can. You know.
So I'm going to say this.
Yeah.
It's just sort of an odd thing to say.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and I had this conversation with John Collins just before he was leaving, and I said to John, I said, you know, my feeling about those years of sort of the after the National Commission and during the Pritzker-Yalvin campaign is none of us had enough, you
mm-hmm.
know.
Mm-hmm.
But we were like all in the same boat, and we were all working furiously.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that, oddly enough, that the way some of the technological platforms have evolved, where faculty increasingly work remotely,
mm-hmm.
and they only come in to teach their classes,
mm-hmm.
and there's a broad level of disengagement that I find troubling.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't think it's like psychology, and I don't think it's IIT. I think this is like a national challenge
sure.
in education.
Mm-hmm. Right.
You know, that I should get a teaching award and go to an event where there's not one faculty member from my college is disheartening,
mm-hmm.
and it's not personal.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
right.
People. We used to have a faculty club where people had lunch together and they met.
Mm-hmm.
It wasn't because we were talking about issues, and it wasn't because, you know, people felt like, you know, they wouldn't go because it would be a waste of your time. Well, people eat lunch, but we don't have. I think the sense of community was really a lot stronger and is eroding, and I think that's related to us being a technological university.
Mm-hmm.
And we have to figure something out about that.
Sure, sure. Because it goes against one of the stated strengths of IIT, which is, you know, interdisciplinary collaboration.
And we're too small to be
yeah.
like that. You know, we're just too small.
I agree with you.
And,
you.
You know, there are times I've gone into buildings and it's a ghost town.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And I find that really difficult. I worry about my children and their future.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
mm-hmm.
and
yeah, I know the old basic social skills, sociability, and whatnot. And that's something I think all of us have speculated about to a certain degree. Are we really marching into a great crisis of
humanity?
Of lack of sociability and humanity. Yeah,
and civility.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's an odd time where people can say almost anything publicly, but people are vilified for the smallest thing, too.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
You know, there's this
yeah.
odd tension between sort of saying really outrageous things and getting away with it, or saying something relatively small and being stumped. And, you know, and if you live in the suburbs, frequently there's nobody home in the suburbs. I'm glad women are working. I think it's good for people. But, you know, nobody's home at the university, nobody's home in the suburbs. It's a difficult culture time.
Yeah, right. The need for the ever increasing productivity and people working 4 or 5 jobs, you know, in various sorts of ways.
And the things that we call productivity and the things that we call data, you know, we have meetings now, people put up ideas and the ideas are called data. You know, they're not data. They're ideas. Some of them are great ideas, and we should talk about them. But there's a shift in how we're conceptualizing things, and I need to do something different.
So what is on the horizon for you?
I'm spending the next year deciding that.
All right.
And I'm not committing anytime soon. I'm spending more time with my adult children who I neglected.
Okay. All right. Well, good there. They're around. How many do you have? And are they all in Chicago Metro, or are they?
Yep, they're all here, and they're all adults, and they're all women, and they're all doing fabulously.
Okay,
great.
All right.
Knock on wood.
Good deal.
Thanks, guys.
Is there anything? Is there anything we haven't covered that you want to get a chance to say, explain? Any stories that I feel like you were hoping you'd get a chance to tell?
I want to talk about the man on the bench.
Oh, great.
All right. Speak for the man on the bench.
So when Lou was leaving, and Judy Carr was organizing a committee of people to give him a send-off, and there was this, you know, intention to roast him, I was on that planning committee, and they were saying, oh, wouldn't it be great if we could have, like, somebody be the man on the bench, because there had been this prank where some students, we think enabled by faculty, took the real man on the bench and snuck it into the president's office. So he came in the morning, which is, you know, a pretty secure place. So somebody had to enable that. And they found the real man on the bench in his office. And Lou is a funny guy. You know, he had a great sense of humor, and, you know, that was a funny thing. So then, so I said, well, if you guys won't tell anybody, I will be the man on the bench. So I swore them to secrecy, and my mother was an artist, and so I created my costume. I went to Goodwill and got clothes, and I slapped drywall mud on them, and I, you know, made this whole thing. And then there was a woman in marketing who helped do the cast of the face after hours in the dark on the real on a real man on the bench. And so I suited up, and the guys from facilities, Frank and I don't remember the name of the other one, carried me out on stage before this thing. And they were so funny, because they were pretending I weighed 100 pounds, and they were groaning, and carrying me out and put me on this bench. And I had a pad from the people in rehab that is used for a person in wheelchairs to not have pressure sores, so that I could sit still. And I did have a good training as a child of learning to sit still. So I sat still next to Lou on the bench. He assumed I really was the man on the bench for almost 40 minutes.
Wow, how did you manage that? Are you sweating to death?
No, well, we had put up a fan because I knew it was going to be hot, and so there was a fan blowing. And so then what I did is I picked up my hand at one point and I put it on Lou's leg, and he jumped like a foot, but I had moved my hand back. And most people didn't even know what was happening because a lot of people didn't see it. But we had a videotape of my daughter, who was watching it later, said, "You are totally cracking up inside your mask. I can see, because I, you know, there's this like oscillation." So I sat very still. And then I did it again a little bit later, at which point Lou hugged me. And the scenario was that this guy who was the MC was supposed to invite me to escort Lou to the podium. But he was from Second City, and he didn't. And so Lou got up, and I could feel the shift in the bench and started walking, and they were calling Lou up. And so then I got up, and I'm starting to follow Lou, and now I look like the swamp monster. Because I have my hand out, I'm trying to reach Lou, but I'm walking in this thing. So then I got to the podium, and I took off my mask, and Lou said, "This is so Lou. Ellen, you've never looked better." So that was a lot of fun.
Oh, that's pretty amazing.
And Mike Oz has the costume.
Oh, wow.
And I told him he could use it for admissions events or other things, and I didn't want to throw it away.
It had to be pretty darn convincing for him not to do this.
Yeah.
Well, good thing if so it was like rubber and sheet and whatnot, you think it was plastered, all fall off of you if you'd start to move.
No, I mean, I had a jacket like your jacket, and I slathered it, and I had a shirt. I mean, I can send you a picture if you want. Okay. Have you ever not seen a picture?
I have seen. Yeah. I've seen one.
I had boots that I had slathered. Like, mm-hmm. I mean, I really did look like the man on the bench.
Wow, very cool.
Yeah, and it was fun. It was a fun thing to do.
Sounds like it.
Different.
Yeah.
Okay.
Well, that's a great place to end. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
We really appreciate you spending the time talking to us.
If I have more stuff, I will send it on.
All right.
Great.
Well, that was a very, very great talk. Hello. This is another in a continuing series of oral history interviews that are being conducted by the University Archives and Special Collections Unit, Paul V. Galvin Library, Illinois Institute of Technology. Today is the 17th of September, 2019, and I am Mindy Pugh, University Archivist. I am co-interviewing with Adam Strum, Director of University Archives and Special Collections, and our return guest today is Dr. M. Ellen Mitchell, with whom we first spoke on the 1st of May, 2018. She's a faculty member in the Department of Psychology and was the first dean of the College of Human Sciences. Dr. Mitchell has listen to her interview that was taped on the 1st of May of last year, and doing us the service of coming in and filling in some of the other aspects of her career. So this part of the interview is going to be much more directed by her. So welcome back.
Thank you, and thank you so much for letting me have an opportunity to fill in a little gap that just slipped my mind last time I was here. And that's about the Leadership Academy, which I think is really one of the most splendid programs that I was able to have a hand in addition to the Boder Project, which was our other splendid project. But it had a sort of an interesting start. You know, me and the university, were in the beginnings of the Pritzker-Galvin match, you know, and everybody was excited about fundraising and match dollars. And I had been at a board meeting in my capacity, and I guess I was called a director. And, you know, seating's a little arbitrary, but I got seated next to Al Self that night. And Al Self, I don't know if you know anything about him, but he was a long-term trustee, a lovely, lovely man who was quite modest and who had done his undergraduate work at Kansas, at KU. And he's really a Kansas fan. He had given Kansas like $40 million for programs there to develop leaders in science. So I was seated next to him at dinner, and, you know, we were just yucking it up. And he said to me, he said, well, if you had questions about sort of early identification of talent, if you wanted to find the people in a discipline who were in most likelihood going to just really excel, you know, like, how would you find Jonas Salk before he got famous? And I said, well, I don't know for sure, but I do know I have faculty who would be able to address this, who just are so expert in selection and in psychometric theory and testing. I said, what I would do first is consult with them. And he started talking about his Kansas program and about how he really thought that if one could identify people of talent early and support them, he could only imagine how much more they might be able to do. And he said, you know, just imagine if you had somebody who was going to be the next, you know, whomever, and they didn't have to have a job in college, and they didn't have to worry about loan debt, you know, and you took that burden from them, how they could really devote themselves to their work. And he started talking to me also about, how do you think you find leaders? You know, there's like scientists over here. What are the qualities of leaders? How do you identify leaders? And so, you know, I told him some of my ideas and what I knew, which is, you know, it's not my area, but I knew a little bit and referred to things my faculty knew. And I left that dinner and I went to Lou Collins. And I said, Lou, I just really think we have an opportunity here. because Al Self is really committed to building leaders, and I think we could do something. And so, so Lou, bless his heart, said, "Go for it." And I worked with Tom Garrow, was the head of fundraising at that time, and Tom had a hand in helping develop a proposal in terms of structure. And Alan Meyerson wanted engineering to be included in, as leaders. And at that time, Gerard Voland was the head of the undergraduate college, and he wasn't really a key person in writing the proposal, but the program would have initially kind of been seated in there. So in any event, we also had hosted Al Self out at the Kinship Trust offices that were headed by Brian Dunn, because Brian's, the Kinship Trust Company, had they had a program of Searle Scholars. And so the Searle family was funding scientists, and so we had the Searle people, and we had Al Self, and we had Kansas people, and we had Bruce Fisher, who was the director of our center, come together to talk about selection and what is a good selection process. And we actually were sort of helping Al, because Al was worried that in Kansas what was happening was that instead of going through a selection process, they were just picking, you know, their favorite student and giving them funding. that the faculty would say, "Oh, this is my mentee, I want to fund them," and not actually sort of doing a selection process, a competitive selection process. So our proposal that we put together for Al included the description for the sophomore leadership camp, which we now host. You probably know about that from George, so I won't talk about that. And a program for those leaders, those who are selected through that process, the from in the Leadership Academy, to get additional mentoring and programming throughout the year. And Al's idea was that they would get full tuition, so they didn't have this financial burden, and they would be sort of early identification of talent to be groomed to go forward, but that we would also have a component that was open to the entire campus, which was the freshman, the sophomore leadership camp. And then, so the scholars had to go, they had to apply, they had to go through a full day of testing, wow, performance-based testing, you know, give a speech with 5 minutes to prepare, and a variety of other things that I probably shouldn't detail because we don't want to give it away. But anyway, so we wrote this proposal, and Alan Meyerson and I met with Al Self, and we asked him for $20 million, which, like, took my breath away, because I'd never asked anybody for a million, let alone $20 million.
Quick question, was Meyerson already provost at that point?
Alan, I think, was dean. He must have been. He must have just transitioned.
Because this is the late 90s?
No, you know, Cooper was.
Okay.
Cooper was the provost, and Alan was the dean of engineering.
Okay.
But we did this over in Lou's office, and, you know, it was one of those things, like I later learned, there's really almost no difference between asking for $1 million or asking for $20 million. It's, you know, if the person had capacity, it's just a number, but at the time, my heart was like, "We're going to ask for $20 million. And, you know, Al listened and he asked questions, and he was very excited. And I remember that Stuart Cooper was the provost, because I got the news, and I had been in life sciences building, and I was like flying over to a meeting, and I passed Stuart Cooper, and I was like, "Stuart, we got $5 million. And that was the start of the Leadership Academy. And I remember Al also saying, we were like, I used to talk with him, I'd say, you know, you could fund psychology, it could be the Self Psychology Institute. That sounds self-psychology, that sounds so good. And he'd laugh, and I'd say, "Well, maybe we should name the Leadership Academy." He said, "No," he said, "I want other people to give to it. Mm-hmm. It shouldn't have my name." And I think John Mitchell, I'm not sure if he was a trustee or not, but I think he also gave $1 million, and then Al had also given additional money for scholarships separately that could be dedicated to it. But, you know, it was just a wonderful idea and Al's commitment to really want to find talent at IIT and support that growth. And it was open to students in every discipline. You know, it wasn't just psychology or just engineering. So we always had students out of architecture and business and design, not design because it was from graduate students, but across the campus. And some great programming speakers and so on. So, you know, thank you, Al.
It sounds like it, because of his commitment and his vision, it sounds like it, I'm sure there are all sorts of little details, but it took off probably better than a lot of other projects. How much did that compete with your time, a very busy time in, you know, your college?
You know, I never felt like it was competing with my time because it was something also the psychology was really good at, you know. So it was selection and leadership development. That was our wheelhouse, you know. And we are the ones on campus who know the most about leadership and organizations. And I went to a couple of the sophomore camps, you know, and stayed overnight. And, you know, I cheered on the played volleyball. I played volleyball even with John Anderson at one of those, and you know, met the students and faculty. Jack Snapper used to often go to the sophomore camp, and it was just such for the students who did it, and we really tried to really encourage all students to do the camp part. It was defining, you know. A lot of them would later say that was the best thing I did here. Was even if they weren't a scholar who was in the small group of 10 who was supported and sort of groomed, even if it was just part of the student body activities, that weekend was a, you know, a defining time for them. Yeah. Great. So anyway, I'd recommend it if you can still volunteer.
Okay. All right. Yeah. What was the role of the Leadership Academy in promoting greater campus integration?
So, you know, some of it, it's a little hard to say because they also pretty early on started coordinating some of the activities with the Camrys students. So Camrys students came in and they didn't have any, like, expectations for delivery. The leadership scholars had some service expectations that, you know, they had to do things, they had to attend the speakers, and then, you know, because some of the activities were open to the full campus, part of their job was to also bring other students into the fold for that. And the service activities, they did a lot of different things. I wouldn't be the best person to recount that at this point, but... you know, I think that the nice thing about it was that it was open to any student in any discipline, and the selection process, if you could shine, you were in. Yeah. You know, on Camrys, you had to be like top three in your graduating class from high school. So that's kind of behind you, right?
Do you think, looking back at this point, that the Leadership Academy did or has done what it was supposed to do?
Gosh, I hope so. And I know a couple of the students are doing fabulously. You know, Hazem Diwani was one of the Leadership Academy students, and he had a business in Option City that was a trading platform that sold. And I think he's on somebody's advisory board. And he's doing some really interesting things. And I'm pretty sure that one of the women, whose name I'm not going to recall, set up an international non-for-profit for... people who are traumatized in that country, but you know, it grows vague this many years down the road because it's probably 20 years now.
Yeah.
Since I don't remember what year it was exactly, but you know, and I'm sure that some of the students might not go on to be like stars, like Michael Jordan kind of stars, you know, but there are many people who do, right? Mm-hmm. You know, we're talking about. But I'm sure that they're talented and successful and doing great things, even if they're not like a singleton.
Sure. Right. But still, that sort of support is still going to make quite an exponential difference in their lives.
Well, and I think Al, you would come on the weekends and talk to the students, and I think that his orientation toward giving back, mm-hmm. you know, and really wanting to take care of others was something that became inculcated in the program. You know, that's part of the service responsibility and part of, you know, the students have to do exercises at the sophomore camp about themselves, about what matters and what are their goals and what are their values and what are their visions. And, you know, a lot of them, I think, use that time to think about things they hadn't really considered. You know, I think they come in just like, I want to get out of school, I want to graduate, I want a degree.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
But this was more like, you know, what's going to make a difference for you?
Mm-hmm.
So.
Yeah, how that fits into their larger world.
Yeah.
Yeah. I know that obviously psychology, as you've discussed before, here at IIT has had such a, you know, industrial component as well, and training and mentoring people to go through organizations and whatnot, but this is still kind of a different slice of the pie or a different sort of thing where there's more values involved.
Yeah.
Discussion of values and that sort of picture, which is not happening too much elsewhere in campus, I'd imagine.
Yeah, so. I think that's right. And you know, part of the reason I wanted to come back to you all is I feel that it's important to also honor Al's self. I mean, I think he did something extraordinary.
Mm-hmm.
And I saw the little videotape that I think Betsy made, which is a great videotape, but I don't think it's complete, mm-hmm. you know, in terms of the person that he was. I once asked him what he thought made him successful, because he was really very successful, obviously. And he said, you know, I think I've always been running a little scared.
And I said,
And he said, you know, if you get too comfortable and complacent, you just stay there. He said, but yeah, if you're just a little scared, you keep out there.
Mm-hmm.
And he said it with this really cute little grin.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And I was like, I can't imagine you being scared.
Mm-hmm.
So it was such a lovely self-disclosure.
Yeah. He was a World War II generation, right? He was a little bit after.
He must have been.
Years.
Yeah.
I know it's all out there, but I'm just
curious. Yeah. And I don't remember. He told me how he named his company Tioga, which was metal finishings, but I don't remember the story. I had it kind of, that's out there somewhere.
Yeah.
But anyway, so
okay.
I don't want to keep you tied up, but I feel like this is the period on the sentence.
Okay, well, great. however you feel. So, yeah.
Thank you.
Well, thanks so much for stopping by again.
All right.
All right, thank you.